From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Namdi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a columnist with the Current Newspapers. Tom Sherwood, Happy New Year. Welcome to not working on television.
You know, it's kind of a relief, you know, the daily, you know, people won't believe it's the daily grind to do a TV story, but, you know, it's kind of nice to actually have time to think. I've thought up better questions maybe for our guest today.
There are those who will say that until this time, he didn't think at all. But now we can look forward to a lot more thought from Tom Sherwood. Also joining us in studio this hour is Muriel Bowser. She is the mayor of the District of Columbia. She's a Democrat who happens to be running for re-election. Mayor Bowser, welcome.
Thank you, Kojo, and Happy New Year to you and all your listeners.
Happy New Year to you. If you have questions or comments for the mayor, you can start calling now, 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org. Send us a tweet at Kojo Show. You can go to our website, kojoshow.org, watch the live video stream of this broadcast, or ask a question or make a comment there. The question you might be asking now is, darn, it's cold outside. What's the mayor doing to help give us some relief from this weather? Well, I have to inform you that she controls a lot of things, but she does not control the weather. But there are steps that can be taken to make sure the district residents are comfortable.
Absolutely. It is very cold, and we've had a pretty sustained period of significantly cold weather this entire week, which we're not really expecting to snap until early next week. And so during cold emergencies, which we have declared, especially in the night hours, we offer more city services. We have more outreach workers out on the street. We have we engage additional warming centers so that we can keep our most vulnerable residents safe.
And you're asking people, when you see someone out in the weather, what do they call? They call 911, 311. What should someone do?
They should call 311, and our 311 operators are trained to get locations for people, to make recommendations for warming centers, to send out a vehicle and a worker to assist a resident. And we do all that we can to get that resident to come inside.
Or call Tom Sherwood. He's doing nothing but thinking these days, so he'll be available to help you. Let's talk about the Virginia House race that was decided by a lottery draw. This occurred, and it was live streamed and seen around the nation yesterday. Ultimately, David Yancey, Republicans, declared a winner in a race that could determine which political party controls the chamber. And since everybody saw this lottery and since it was done so dramatically, one would think that, well, it's all over now. The Republicans have an advantage in the House of 51-49, and that's it.
Well,
that's
almost
not it.
Not it. I think the biggest thing, I watched the drawing on streaming from the Virginian Pilot yesterday, and it was great publicity for the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts. They had this great something wheel thrown bowl that they drew the names from. And I thought that was great for them. But, you know, this race is it's not over. It occurred in November. There were court cases, and then it was the tide, and then now they had this drawing from the bowl. Mr. Yancey, David Yancey won. He's a Republican. It gives the Republicans the majority. But the Democrat, she may challenge it again for another recount. And if that's the case, Yancey won't be seated. It's just quite the mess in Virginia politics, but that's what happens. You know, some 35 states, and I think the District of Columbia, have some kind of game of chance if there's a rare chance where somebody is tied. So it's still uncertain who's going to be running the House. But it looks more and more like the Republicans will be barely in charge, and that'll make things different for Governor Ralph Northam when he's sworn in next weekend.
The Baltimore Sun is reporting that Maya Rockymore Cummings has suspended her campaign for governor. She was one of many candidates running for governor of Maryland. She had the endorsement of the national political group Emily's List, and she did make, as a matter of fact, she was the last candidate to appear on this broadcast before Warren, my boss.
We ran her out of the race.
So it would appear, even though she said this was due to personal considerations.
Yeah, she said due to personal considerations. I don't know what those are, but it might be that as well known as she is in the work she's done in various communities, and the mayor would know this, it's kind of hard to jumpstart a campaign at the top of the ticket. And she's going to run for governor. Her husband, Elijah Cummings, very well-known member of Congress. But, you know, it's tough out there for political candidates. And we don't know why, what the personal considerations are. But it may be that this just seemed to be more daunting than what she expected. Wish her well. Part of the problem, though, is in a year in which more and more women are running for our offices, this takes one more woman out of the campaign contest.
Indeed, in your last column in the Northwest Courant, you called it the Year of the Woman.
Yes, because across the nation, this because of the sexual harassment issues, which we'll talk to the mayor about also, is that, you know, women are shaking off this idea that they can be supporters, they should be the candidates.
And I think that's also what you saw in Virginia. So we don't know what will ultimately happen with that seat. But what we do know is that in November, you had a big blue wave move through Virginia. And women were among many first-time candidates who turned seats from Republican to Democrat.
I had thought maybe that Ms. Cummings might be joining one of the other candidates for Democrats for the lieutenant governor. In the coming weeks, they all have to pick their lieutenant governor candidates. But I was unable this morning before the show to confirm whether that's the case or not. But that's another thing to watch in the state. What are the male candidates, the six male candidates are running, will they pick women as their running mates?
And Mayor Bowser, this next issue is one which I'll talk about in Montgomery County, but I'd like you to chime in on, because thousands of homeowners in Montgomery County rushed to prepay their 2018 property taxes because they're after the legislation was passed changing the tax code in Congress. They understood that their property taxes might be going up, so they decided that it would be better if they paid their property taxes for 2018 in 2017. And then the IRS issued an order saying that if you have not received an assessment for 2018, you should not be paying it in 2017. So there's a great deal of confusion about what's going to happen to those property owners in Maryland. And inquiring minds would like to know what the situation is in the District of Columbia.
Well, our read, now the IRS issued some guidance as it relates to how deductions for property taxes for the 2018 liability would be handled in 2017. And our property tax liability in D.C. becomes effective in 2017, and our CFO issues, because we know what the rate is and we know what the assessments will be in, you know, the broad range of the assessment, that's when the tax liability begins. So we think that we fit right in the example that the IRS provided of how a 2018 liability could be deductible in 2017. We had over 7,000 people come to prepay their property taxes, and we've already collected in advance $50 million in property tax assessments.
Wow, so the Trump administration is good for you.
Well, it's going to even out. We're not getting an extra year of property taxes. We're just getting them early.
The deal is that under the tax, the new tax reform, I don't want to call it reform, the tax law changes, is that it was capped at $10,000. So a lot more than $10,000 in property taxes.
It's not just the property taxes that were capped. It was the property taxes in addition to your state income taxes that were capped at $10,000. So there will be many people, and you know, we are one of the jurisdictions that have a high number of itemizers who will exceed the new expanded standard deduction who may have a negative impact.
So it's property
impact.
And state and local taxes capped at $10,000?
Yes.
Each or total?
Total.
Total. Total.
Call your accountant.
And then call your lawyer. Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced yesterday he is rescinding the Obama-era guidelines that relax marijuana enforcement at the federal level. Now federal prosecutors will be able to enforce federal marijuana laws more aggressively. There's always been tension in states where pot is legal or decriminalized because it's still illegal at the federal level. So what do you think this attorney general's move will mean for the district?
I don't really have any idea what Maine Justice, as they say, is going to do. We haven't gotten any additional guidance from the U.S. attorney assigned for the District of Columbia. I can tell you, Kojo, that our approach and our policing approach to these issues hasn't changed, and it's not going to change. But I think one thing that is very clear is that we have relied too long strong on kind of informal guidance at the federal level, and we need the Congress to step in and pass a law to make some sense out of the marijuana laws across the nation.
Glad you brought Congress up, because Tom Sherwood, I talked this morning with Adam Eidinger, the chair of the D.C. Cannabis Campaign, and he had what I considered to be a fairly unique approach to this. He said, look, home rule in the District of Columbia is a federal law, and it gives the district the right to have ballot initiatives. And unless the results of those initiatives are overturned by the Congress, then that is, in fact, a federal law, and that we are the only jurisdiction in the country to have the legalization of marijuana under federal law, so to speak.
Well, you know, it's interesting to me when people want to cloak themselves in our unique status when it's favorable and then want to throw that coat to the ground when it's not. But I think that's a little unique. Mayor, you have a comment on that?
No, I just think it continues to speak to we. I feel strongly that we're not in the right place in the district with our marijuana laws, because we have the ability to possess, but not the ability to legally procure
or to tax.
And so that is something that requires a fix. But now we see the other states who have legalized marijuana, either medically or for recreational purposes, that are kind of finding themselves in the position that we're in now. There are people who have passed a law that is now under some serious scrutiny from Maine Justice.
Yeah, you know, let me just very quickly, we've got a lot of subjects today. You know, Colorado takes in about $1 billion. It's about $1 billion in sales. Thousands of people are employed. Taxes are generated. California has now done it. It's only like 3 or 4 states out of the entire country that doesn't have some kind of marijuana law for either medical purposes or recreation. And for the Justice Department, Attorney General Sessions, to say, well, he's going to tell the U.S. attorneys to stop all the other work they're doing and go after marijuana smokers again, it's just not going to happen. It's just not going to happen.
And it's wrong for public safety.
Right.
I think what
– immoral, I think. Once either Brian – somebody said called it immoral to even – this.
And what we've seen is that we can have our police focus on real crimes, violent crimes, and not on petty possession. And
right.
That has freed them up to help drive down, total crime and violent crime in the District of Columbia over the last years. And actually, I also think it improves our ability to work with communities where our police don't have to interact with them for petty possession.
We had something like 5,000 arrests in the city, and now we're down to a few hundred.
As Tom Sherwood likes to say, this is the politics hour, damn it. Your reelection campaign is shifting into high gear with no major opponent in sight. You've already raised nearly $1.5 million. Take it from there, Sherwood.
Well, I looked at the campaign contributions, and there's, you get $1,000 from somebody called David Catania. Gave you $1,000. I thought that was interesting. He was your opponent in 2014.
He's been a wonderful supporter.
And on this show, David Grosso, council member, very progressive, who many thought might challenge you, sat in the very chair you're sitting in and said, what a great job you're doing. You know, the whole program was falling apart. And then Carl Racine, the attorney general who geared up and tried to see if he would run against you, he decided not to run, and he sat at the same chair you're sitting in.
But there still is one gray area.
Well, I want to finish my laudatory stuff first before we get to that. And then he said that since he decided not to run, his relationship with you is great, and you're doing great things together, attorney general. That leaves, and I looked at the list, there's only like five little-known or unknown candidates against you, none of whom have any citywide recognition. So that leaves Vince Gray. Vince Gray, who you defeated 4 years ago. What is your relationship with him? Have you talked to him about maybe you guys working together, or do you think he'll run against you? Where are you? What's your assessment of Vince Gray? And I know you'll run against anyone. You're going to run hard. I know all the cliche answers. But have you talked to him, and do you think you guys can work something out where you can work together with him as a Ward 7 council member?
Well, I do work with him as a Ward 7 council member, just like I work with all of the members of the council. We want to know what's important to the council member, and we want to work within, our laws and with the budget. budget to make sure that we can deliver for our constituents in Ward 7. So when I approached this, this reelection, I was here, actually. I announced on your show back in September. I said we would build a campaign so that we could go across every ward and talk to every voter about what we've been able to accomplish over the last 3 years. And, you know, I'm proud to be able to go with the voters and say that we've kept promises and we're delivering for the city. And the thing that makes me most happy is when I go to these neighborhoods, when I talk to businesses, and I would talk to people in general about their city, and they're very proud. And they know that the government is working the way it should be. They're proud of their leaders, and they're optimistic about the future.
Well, you know, I looked at your campaign. There are issues that you've had to address. One is that you've worked very hard. When you first ran, and this was somewhat sexist as opposed to just being true, but some people said, oh, you're like Adrian Fenty, you're not warm and fuzzy. And I haven't heard that for almost 2 years now. I mean, it seems to me you've worked on showing the personality that you have that people who know you see. You've addressed the issue of pay to play. It was one of the big issues in the start of your campaign with the Fresh Pack thing that blew up in your face, and you had to abandon that. Your current contribution list shows that you've gone out of your way to make sure you have individual donations.
According to campaign chairman Bill Lightfoot, 85% of contributions come from individual donations, but there does seem to be a kind of bundling going on from some companies, if you will, in which reports that employees for one company can combined for $17,000 in contributions, another company for another $11,000 or so. Is that a concern to you?
No, I am. And we talk about this every time on the show, and I tell you, as I will tell you today, that we have broad and wide support from across the city, and I'm very proud of that. People are investing in our campaign because they want 4 more years for us to finish the job that we've started. When I started my campaign 4 years ago, people were very concerned about affordable housing. And we've been able to focus on it with a laser so that we have doubled the amount of affordable housing dollars in all of my 3 budgets, and we'll do it again this year, so that we have delivered 5,000 units of affordable housing. And I know in the next 4 years, we will be able to do more of the same. When I was last here, I talked to you about a bill that I authored around government ethics and accountability. And I think that the residents of the District of Columbia can be very proud of how BEGA is working.
That's the Board of Ethics and Government Accountability.
Yes, that trains our workers, that provides them with advice, that enforces the rules and the law if they're broken. Because what I have found is that our 33,000 employees and the vast number of public officials that we have, they want to do the right thing.
Well, Mayor, the council, Charles Allen from Ward 6, passed new ethics laws and new campaign laws that will limit corporate donations from others. But those, all of those new restrictions don't take place until the next election.
Actually, I think what they're considering is a public financing bill
that
public
has financing.
Nothing to do with corporate contributions.
Well, I think there might be, if you have a contract with the city, you can't donate to a campaign or something. But do you think there needs to be tougher rules on corporate donations? Bundling is not uncommon, as Kojo just mentioned it. Do you support tougher laws on who can give and who can't give in campaigns?
I think we have some of the strictest campaign restrictions that exist. In our ward races, people or corporations are limited to $500 contributions. It goes up to $2,000 for a citywide race like mine. We have very stringent disclosure requirements as well. And so I think that everything that we should do around campaigning and fundraising is to make sure that voters have the best information in the most digestible format as quickly as possible.
I have one more. This is Ben Soto. Has been your campaign treasurer, I think, since your first race for the council.
Yep.
He's not your treasurer this time. Why not? Where has he gone?
He hasn't gone anywhere. He's very much involved in our campaign, but he asked me to take a break.
And no, you could, now can I just, this is, I haven't met her yet, but Jody Ovca, uh-huh. O-V-C-A,
yes.
Is your new treasurer.
She is.
I was looking her up. She knows a lot about feng shui and putting furniture around different places. She's a yoga person. And then she's also involved in mediation issues.
That's correct.
Who is she and where did she come from?
She's a very talented attorney.
Excuse me. I was told that one thing she brings is that she's very good at numbers and she will not get into any it's situations where you had in your last campaign where you had to refund some monies out of the money you raised.
Let me just say that I'm working on my sixth campaign, and we have worked with a number of very talented people, and Jody is just a fantastic addition to our team. She's a very talented attorney. She works well. She has a great network of folks, and she's helped us bring in a team, an accounting firm, to also assist us with a lot of contributions. In our last campaign, we had over 7,000 contributions, raised over $2.7 million, and so it is important that we be able to have the systems in place to be confident in the reports that we send to OCF, and we're doing that. Jody and I got to know each other in a leadership class that many people in Washington take.
And, the Leadership Washington?
Yes.
Okay,
and
cool.
I'm glad that she's on board.
Now, did we answer the question about Vince Gray? Did you actually speak to him yet about what his plans are? Do you have a sense? You know, he always starts late. If he runs, he'll do a sprint, not a long campaign.
It's not usually my practice to tell people or one way or the other what they
should do. But aren't you curious? Don't you want to know?
I will know. We'll all know 45 days after petitions become available.
Petitions come out late January 26th.
Well, we got a lot to talk about. We got schools. We got housing. But somebody, Alan in Washington, D.C., wants to talk about roadways. So put on your headphones, please, because Alan is right here. Alan, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hey, Coach O. Thank you for taking my call. I appreciate it. And I've been trying to get through for years, so I'm so happy. But I wanted to talk to the mayor about a few items.
Let's start
one
with one.
Just actually one then. But one of them is about the conditions of the roads. And who is in charge of taking care of the roads in the district? And I've noticed that as someone that was born and raised in the district, in Anacostia my entire life, the road conditions all over the city are in terrible conditions. And I've noticed that all the entryways into the city seem to be having a lot of road work done and refurbishing of the roads, but a lot of the roads in general through the city are in really bad condition.
So let me answer that question, Alan, and I'll answer it in two parts. So the news is good around our main arterials, where most of those are in pretty good shape. They get a good to fair rating, and we're working constantly every year to make sure that the ratings that they get are even better than that. Where we are struggling is with our local roads, and we have more than 30% of those local roads that get a failing rating, a poor rating. So I got my team together this year when we did the budget, the FY18 budget, to say that we need a prolonged plan. And we have a 5-year plan that is a state of good repair plan where we have increased funding for our local roads and we'll be rolling out this spring a revamped effort to do more and more roads. In the last 3 years, we've worked on a program called Alleypalooza that we do 8 alleys and 8 wards in 8 weeks. And through that effort, we're about to complete our 6th Alleypalooza in more than 400 alleys. And we need a similar packaged effort around our local roads. And more than that, we need to continue our partnership with the council so that we're not kind of doing away with $1 million here, $1 million there when it comes to roads, because it compounds over years. And that's how we get where we are with our local roads.
This was a big issue with Tony Williams when he was mayor, and he's doing a big road building fixing campaign. And then he said, and once we fix this road, you utilities cannot tear it up for at least 5 years. I've noticed that the utility work, because we have, the good news is we have development.
Yep.
The bad news is that means you have to dig up the infrastructure. It means digging up the roads. And I noticed that the utility companies, whoever in charge, don't put the road back the way it was. It's depressions or it's lumps or bumps.
Yeah, well, we have a protocol, Tom, and we do have to do a better job, I think, at DDOT. And Alan S., who's responsible, is DDOT in D.C. that's largely responsible for roads. I'll leave a caveat with that because some of those are federal roads like the Rock Creek Parkway, which is under construction now, and the federal government's taking care of that.
But I just mean Jeff Marudian is your new DDOT person.
That's correct.
But if we just get the utilities, say you have to repair the road the way it was,
yes,
not leave these gaping holes.
We have not spoken with you since WMU's Kate McGee reported on graduation rates at Ballou High School, where every senior was allowed to graduate and received a diploma, despite half of those students having missed more than 90 days of school. Well, every student was not allowed to graduate, but every student was accepted to college. We have heard from school's chancellor, Wilson. The assumption of many is that DCPS is under pressure from your administration to mark dramatic improvements in struggling schools, which is fine, but too much pressure is what they feel may have led to what happened at Ballou.
I think that we all have a responsibility to make sure that we're improving public education in the district. And that's exactly what we've done. The mayor's offices, not just mine, but previous mayors and the council and all of the groups that have supported our very dramatic investment in school reform over the last 10 years. We take the allegations that have been lobbed at Ballou very seriously. Our Office of the State Superintendent for Education, which is our state education agency and regulator, is investigating. Ossie has hired a firm who is expert in these types of investigations.
That's the state education folks.
That's correct. I asked them for a 45-day turnaround on their investigation, and I expect a preliminary report in the next couple of weeks. Councilmember Grasso has also held a hearing where Chancellor Wilson and Superintendent Kang presented the facts as we know them. So this is what everyone should expect. We're going to get to the bottom of any problems. We're going to find out if our attendance policies actually make sense. I think there was some question about if the policy itself needs to be revamped. And more than that, we want to make sure that every adult in every school knows how to implement the policy and do it consistently.
But it's clear that attendance needs to be improved. You were recently at Jefferson Middle School,
yes,
talking to students about the importance of attendance. That is part of an initiative aimed at getting kids to show up to school. Beyond making speeches and appearances, how are you and DCPS aiming to boost attendance, including what emerged from the investigation at Ballou, and that is some of the root causes of absenteeism?
Well, the report about Ballou is not complete, so I think that we should see exactly what's in place. And I'll tell you, a few years ago, Kojo, while I was still on the council, then Chancellor Henderson, talked to me about one of the concerns that she had that was preventing kids from getting to school, and that was transportation. And so those, I guess it's been about 4 or 5 years ago now, I authored the law and got funded and worked with DDOT to get implemented the Kids Ride Free program. Prior to Kids Ride Free, families were paying about $30 per kid per month so that they could get on the bus to go to school. And with Kids Ride Free, now they use their DC1 card, first on the bus and now on the bus and rail to get to school. We also have been investing in food at schools for breakfast and lunch and taking home to make sure that families are getting the additional support that they need. But our biggest responsibility, in my view, when it comes to attendance, is making sure that we're ready for kids, that we have caring, loving adults who are there for them each and every day with high expectations that make learning fun and relevant for our kids. And that is our day in and day out commitment.
My worry about this, if I just very quickly, is it's like at Ballou, when students don't go to Ballou or they drop out and then the school loses per pupil student funding and then things get worse. Why not, like a place like Ballou, why not overstaff it? Why not provide more programs there to make the students want to come to the school rather than have them subjected to things like per pupil funding and losses of teachers when they don't have full enrollment?
Well, I think that we have ways to get additional resources to school, especially when they have at-risk students. And the chancellor is very committed to making sure those at-risk student funds are adding to additional programs and services, adding to the portfolio, not filling gaps. And
our guest is
our challenge.
Our guest is Muriel Bowser.
There were more.
Muriel Bowers is mayor of the District of Columbia. She is currently running for re-election. And since we're talking about schools, we thought it might be a good idea to hear from students. Joining us now is Benjamin Korn. He is the co-editor-in-chief at The Beacon. That's the Woodrow Wilson High School newspaper. Benjamin Korn, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Go right ahead.
Well, before I begin, I have to agree with what the mayor said. The Kids Ride Free program is a big help, and that is a well-run program.
But you just disqualified yourself.
But now on to a slightly more hard-hitting topic. So the Beacon reported that 6 years ago, Wilson opened to a beautiful $115 million renovation, and the building is still in good shape, except for the bathrooms and the water fountains. We investigated and found that over 70 items are broken, including half the soap dispensers, a third of the water fountains, and most bathrooms have at least one broken toilet or urinal. Many have more. And we found that there's this disconnect between the custodial staff and the Department of General Services, who is responsible for fixing these broken items. Whether the custodial staff don't know that the items need to be reported, whether they're without the supplies to actually fix the items, they don't have the expertise or the time. And so as DGS and your administration continues on this extensive campaign across the city to make these schools top tier, how can we ensure that these simple, seemingly simple items
right.
Don't
which can often
blemish.
Be the most annoying.
Exactly.
Right. Well, first of all, we don't want the kids to have to even worry about the administration of maintenance issues. So that is something that we want to take on, Ben, to make sure that the adults in the school, starting with the principal and working with our custodial staff and everybody at DGS, is very proactive about dealing with this. So when they walk through the building, they should say, this isn't right, and I'm going to work the process, but I'm also going to agitate to make sure that these items are fixed. I had the opportunity to read your article, and I should say that I was Ben's council member for all of his life, and I'm very proud of the work that he's doing at the Beacon, and he's participated in some of the student roundtables that we have hosted down at City Hall. And so what they're doing at the Beacon is extremely good work. And so we want to make sure that we have all the adults communicating to get these things done. Now, one thing that was highlighted in your article, and I'm going to challenge our students at Wilson to also be a part of the solution. Now, we can make things so that they're very tough and that they're durable. But we all have a responsibility to take care of our school buildings so that when things get broken because of wear and tear, that's one thing. When things are getting broken because they're being misused, that's another thing entirely. So that's something that the school staff and the student leaders and student government, I want us to all kind of lock arms to make sure that we're taking care of our building.
Mayor, there used to be, I think until Alan Lute got into it, there were thousands, hundreds of thousands of back orders on maintenance issues. And whether students are vandalizing the bathroom or whether it's broken because of poor work or poor quality materials, they still need to be fixed. Are you confident the school system has a way of getting into and fixing the problems, whether it's a student's fault or whether it's because it's bad, shoddy work?
I think what I read in the article was something that I really like to hear, and it was some of the staff that sounded to me like they were saying they needed to be empowered to do more. And part of Chancellor Wilson's focus is how do we give schools more autonomy so that in some cases they can disconnect right. from the central bureaucracy and take care of things in the school. Now, I don't know enough about the details of this or if Wilson would be a great candidate for this. But when I have staff who say, I could do more with more if you give me more autonomy or you empower me to make those fixes, that's another question.
Kathleen in Maryland has a question about school funding. I'm not sure I understand it, so I'll leave it to you, Kathleen, to ask it. You're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you for taking my call, and Madam Mayor, thank you for your public service.
Thank you.
So my question is that over the years, I have noticed that it appears that there's, in my view, an excessive amount of funding that goes towards school boards and school administration, and that perhaps trying to pare down some of the administrative costs or the size of administration, and perhaps do exactly what you were just remarking, Madam Mayor, and that is providing more money directly to the schools and providing more autonomy. It just seems that we have ballooned so much in the administrative level that perhaps it is affecting the amount of money that's going directly to the individual schools. And I can certainly take any comments off the air.
Sure. I don't have we are always looking for ways to be more efficient. And one of our commitments this year that we were able to get funded was to make a bigger investment in our school staff. I think most people know that our teachers were working without a contract for more than 5 years and for a lot of different reasons before I became mayor, that didn't happen. And for 2 years, to be fair, I also was working very hard to figure out how we could come to a solution. And this year, we were able to do that. So now, for the first time in 5 years, our teachers are getting the raise that they deserve. And that is one of the biggest investments that you can make in a school building. Our deputy mayor for education is also working on this question of more autonomy and with the chancellor and making sure that we have a system where schools can earn the ability to focus a little bit more. I'm about to go into the budget season for the upcoming budget. All of our directors, including the chancellor, have been challenged to identify where they can find savings. And none of us would tolerate a cut in schools, but there may be opportunities for us to streamline our central office.
Can we go to health?
Well, I have a question for Benjamin Korn. Do you intend to pursue a career in journalism, Benjamin?
Definitely on the table. Definitely someone looking at it.
Would city government be one of the things you'd be interested in covering?
Yes, very much so.
Well, then hang around for the next few minutes and we'll show you how it's done.
I thought you asked your question very well.
Thank
a lot
you.
Shorter than Mark Plotkin.
So, I appreciate that.
Tom said that.
Very serious issue, Mayor, across the river, United Medical Center. The Ward 8 school board member from Deal Transition here, Marcus Batchelor, wrote in the Washington Post that recently the United Medical Center board, appointed by the mayor, voted in secret to permanently close the obstetrics unit at United Medical Center, leaving thousands of expecting mothers and unborn babies in this city's poorest corners without immediate access to health care. I'm told that we all know that United Medical Center is a mess and that you've taken some steps there, but is there any way to get that obstetrics clinic back open for the people there? It's a real problem. I'm told that you're facing a problem that you're going to have to put more city money into United Medical Center. Well, council is demanding that there be a new contractor over there, not Veritas. Is there anything of any hope you can hold out to the people on the east end of the city that health care is going to get better?
Yes, and I would start by saying we've worked over a number of years. Prior mayors have worked on this issue as well. And the issue with UMC, and I try to help, I think we talked about this the last time, it's not just a bricks and mortar issue. It's not a real estate issue. It's not about who the consultants are. It's about how we really make sure that we have primary care doctors, specialty doctors, and that we have a quality quality healthcare facility there. The bottom line is we had, I think, over 10,000 babies born in D.C. Last year or the year before that. So it's a significant number of babies for a city our size. And many of them were born to mothers who live on the east side of our city.
If I may interrupt, indeed, we got a tweet from Tim Faust or somebody with a similar name who says babies in Ward 8, where over half of all children live in poverty, are about 10 times as likely as babies in Ward 3, the richest part of the city, to die before their first birthday.
And that's a terrible, none of us should be proud of that statistic, but I think it had that to go to that question has more to do with how do we improve opportunity across our city and close the income gaps that we see across our city. And then we'll see better health outcomes for people in every income category.
Mayor,
but I'm going, the point that I was making earlier is women in Ward 7 and 8 are following their doctors. Only 400 babies were born at UMC in the last year, and I think a similar number in the year previous to that. So if we want women to access health care closer to their homes, we have to make sure that their doctors are also working closer to their homes and using the health care facilities there.
And you do that by how? Making sure is there any way to, even if it's a temporary basis, to get obstetrics there reopened so that people who don't have a doctor, many people don't have a doctor, they just...
Well, I think we have to ask ourselves, is that what's in the best interest of our residents? And what all the medical professionals will tell you is hospital facilities and lines of service at hospital facilities are best when volumes ensure high-quality staff and experienced staff. When you have low volumes of births, you don't have the staff there who has the experience to deal with real high-risk births.
In Prince George's County now is going to build a huge hospital not very far, just a couple of miles from this.
Right.
This
the facility. Bottom line is we want every mother and every person to have high access to high-quality health care. And my view is that we have to have a new system on the east side of the city. Is it going to happen overnight? It hasn't happened overnight, but we have a plan moving forward. So we have first focused on where the location of the new facility would be. We're working with some experts in determining how we put the right lines of service there. And I've also asked my team to work on the financial incentives because there are a lot of issues. Why our specialty doctors, ear, nose, and throat, obstetrics and gynecology, aren't working on the east side of our city. And we have to change
the dilemma that now confronts us. We only have about 8 or 9 minutes left. We have not discussed housing. We have not discussed crime. And we have
crime is down.
Several people, we want to address the issue of housing. So please take notes because I'm going to go to several people. We'll start with a tweet from Jamie. Jamie, who says, with an increase in housing stock, but with an affordable housing crisis and tougher new requirements for homeless services, would you support completely redefining what affordable housing means here in D.C.? This is Jamie Sycamore, who is a candidate for a Ward 1 council seat. But then we go to the phones. Here now is Cece in Washington. Cece, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you very much. D.C. is the only jurisdiction in North America with annual property reassessments. If you support affordable housing, why did the government repeal the public advocate for assessments and taxation law in 2016? The law had been in the code since 1999. Isn't this a contradiction?
I'm not exactly familiar with the repeal that Cece was talking about, but if his point is how do we make sure that our property tax assessments are fair, we very much advocate for that, and we have an appeals process that's outlined in the law. We do have an ombudsman, and actually our I think Brenda Donald continues to be the ombudsman that's responsible for working with property taxpayers and OTR to make sure that, you know, there was a period of time when we thought there were some illegal assessments and people were being really fined out of their homes. And that's what the ombudsman is there for. But I do think there are opportunities to make sure that we continue to look for ways to cut property taxes for families that could be priced out of their homes because of increases.
And very quickly, I would say to people who complain about assessments being too high, I've, for several years on this program and others, I would say, I'll buy your property for whatever it's assessed at. And I never got anyone to say they would do that because they don't want the assessments to go up. But if you ask them how much they will sell their property for, they give you a different answer. The city does reassessments every year because you can.
We do, but we also have a cap in the city. Right. So even though your assessment may go up, your tax bill cannot go up more than 10%. Now, some people, including myself, want to examine if there is a way to have that cap lower.
Okay. Well, as I said, we do want to get to crime and law enforcement. But I think Benjamin Korn, co-editor-in-chief of the Beacon, the Woodrow Wilson High School newspaper, has another question. Lesson number two, interrupt. Go ahead.
As you know, it's college admission season, and parents and students alike were worried about the health and even the existence of the D.C. TAG program, which helps D.C. public school students go to universities around the country, given the fact that, although we have UDC, we do not have a state college comparable to those other colleges that we get money to go to. So as Capitol Hill looks at this program, what are you planning to do to preserve it from congressional cuts?
We have been fighting for DC TAG in the 3 years that we've been here. And I, as mayor, established a new federal and regional affairs office where we not only work with the Congress, but work with the White House. Our threat right now is, quite frankly, at OMB on the White House side. And so we're waiting to see what they're going to do. But regardless of what we do, we know that DC TAG is a creation of the Congress, and the Congress has always been really supportive of it. Not only does it help D.C. families, but it also helps those universities back at the home states of the Congress people who have supported it. So not only do we want to maintain the allotment that we have, I think we've requested $40 million, and that's what we're going to go and fight for at the Congress. But it is an example of how a change priority at the federal level can impact the district, and that our Congresswoman has been very effective on the House side, but we don't have similar advocacy with a person.
That would be Eleanor Holmes North.
Very quickly, before we get to crime, maybe we can end on that because that's such a big issue. Very quickly, Mayor, the soccer field is rising near my neighborhood. Are you still for the Redskins coming back to town if they build the stadium and the city doesn't incur a heavy amount of expenses to bring them back?
Yes.
Earlier this week, crime stats for the district were released. You and Police Chief Newsham recently announced that violent crime is down 22% in the city compared to the previous year, but there's still a ways to go, and homicides, for example, were still high and concentrated in some areas of the city. How do you plan to address that?
Well, what we saw, Kojo, there's always work to do. None of us are going to be satisfied with any level of violent crime in our city, but we saw and we've seen over the last several years a 14% decrease in crime overall, and a 28% decrease in violent crime. So not only are our police doing a great job, but the chief likes to say he has gotten just a dramatic amount of support from sister agencies who are really responsible for crime prevention and for really making sure that we're creating opportunities. People won't be drawn into a life of crime.
City is also trying to address what victim advocates have long seen as a shameful backlog in testing rape kits. You said that backlog has been eliminated. How was that accomplished, and was it accomplished to the satisfaction of the victim advocates tonight?
Well, we have had a focus on our crime lab. Many people know that one of the U.S. attorney walked into my office on day one or day two and discontinued their relationship with our DNA lab. And we have worked over 3 years, and I want to acknowledge Chairman Mendelson and the council who have supported our pretty significant request at the crime lab to get the people and the procedures in place to make that happen. And it's having a real impact on crime.
Back on the crime, Mark Seagraves from Channel 4 did his story about the good numbers, the great numbers to run for re-election on, but he also said in Wards 5 and 7, people don't feel safe, and that the homicide closure rate, which is tied at 71%, includes the cold cases that aren't really affecting day-to-day lives. What are you doing in Ward 7 and Ward 5 where people don't feel as safe because their numbers are not as good as the citywide numbers?
Well, we have doubled down in our police service areas where we see violence, where we see guns fired, and we have seen homicides. And we will not rest until people feel safe in their neighborhoods. We also opened in Ward 7, and I think you know Councilmember McDuffie authored a piece of legislation called the NEAR Act, which is really focused on crime prevention. We opened that office in Ward 7. We hired a new director whose focus will be on the few number, and I want to emphasize this point, there are few number of people who cause violence in the city. Many of them have been violent offenders before, have used guns before, and we want to target them for additional services.
Chief Lanier said that too. I mean, when she was the chief 8 years ago, she said the same thing.
And it is true. And so the strategy we're using now with the Safer, Stronger Office of Neighborhood Safety and Engagement is to target those individuals
and
with jobs and opportunity.
And I'm afraid that's it for the show today. Mayor Bowser, thank you so much for joining us.
I didn't get to DCRA, the most hated agency in town.
Mayor Bowser, thank you for joining us.
Thank
Good
you.
Luck to you.
Thank you.
Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a columnist with the Current Newspapers. And Benjamin Korn is the co-editor-in-chief at The Beacon, the Woodrow Wilson High School newspaper. Benjamin, thank you for joining us. That's it for the show today. Don't forget to meet us back here on Monday. We'll be talking about the announcement by U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions reversing the hands-off policy of the Justice Department when it comes to states that have legalized marijuana. Until then, thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nam.
WAMU 88.5 is your listener-supported NPR news station in the greater Washington, D.C. region. You can support the Kojo Namdi Show and all the regional coverage you value by becoming a member today. Click the donate button at WAMU.org, and thanks.